Okay, girls, today I'm giving you the inside scoop on my favorite place to save this spring. At Ross, it's the spot to get everything you need at prices you'll love. Because when you find brand names for 20 to 60% off other retailers' prices, you'll definitely be finding your next favorite outfit and more. Trust me, you don't want to miss out on these deals on your favorite dresses and tops. And at this price, you might as well throw in a new purse or pair of shoes too. But Ross isn't just about savings, they're about giving back. This year, Ross and their customers raised over $4.1 million to support the Boys and Girls Club and local youth programs to help kids and families thrive. Seriously, just visit your local Ross and see for yourself, because I know you like to keep your closet full and your costs low. So what are you waiting for? Say yes for less at your local Ross.
Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, stain, tools, flooring, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online from May 8th through May 14th. Not a member? Join MyLowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Part the second, chapter 14 of Dick Sands, the Boy Captain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alex C. Talander, Davis, California. Dick Sands, the Boy Captain, by Jules Verne. Translated by Ellen E. Frewer. Part the Second, Chapter 14, A Ray of Hope. Mrs. Weldon's first feeling on being left alone was a sense of relief at having a week's respite. She had no trust in Negoro's honesty, but she knew well enough that their marketable value would secure them from any personal danger, and she had time to consider whether some compromise might be effected by which her husband might be spared the necessity of coming to Kazonde. Upon the receipt of a letter from herself, he would not hesitate for a moment in undertaking the journey, but she entertained no little fear that after all perhaps her own departure might not be permitted. The slightest caprice on the part of Queen Moena would detain her as a captive, whilst as to Negoro, if one he should get the ransom he wanted, he would take no further pains in the matter. Accordingly, she resolved to make the proposition that she should be conveyed to some point upon the coast, where the bargain could be concluded without Mrs. Weldon coming up the country. She had to weigh all the consequences that would follow any refusal on her part to fall in with Negoro's demands. Of course, he would spend the interval in preparing for his start to America, and when he should come back and find her still hesitating, was it not likely that he would find scope for his revenge in suggesting that she must be separated from her child? The very thought sent a pang through her heart, and she clasped her little boy tenderly to her side. "What makes you so sad, mamma?" asked Jack. "I was thinking of your father, my child," she answered. "Would you not like to see him?" "Yes, yes. Is he coming here?" "No, my boy, he must not come here." "Then let us take Dick and Tom and Hercules and go to him." Mrs. Weldon tried to conceal her tears. "Have you heard from Papa?" "No." "Then why do you not write to him?" "Write to him?" repeated his mother. "This is the very thing I was thinking about." The child little knew the agitation that was troubling her mind. Meanwhile, Mrs. Weldon had another inducement, which she hardly ventured to own to herself for postponing her final decision. Was it absolutely impossible that her liberation should be effected by some different means altogether? A few days previously she had overheard a conversation outside her hut, and over this she had found herself continually pondering. Alves and one of the Ujiji dealers, discussing the future prospects of their business, mutually agreed in denouncing the efforts that were being made for the suppression of the slave traffic, not only by the cruisers on the coast, but by the intrusion of travellers and missionaries into the interior. Alves averred that all these troublesome visitors ought to be exterminated forthwith. "But kill one and another crops up," replied the dealer. "Yes, their exaggerated reports bring up a swarm of them," said Alves. It seemed a subject of bitter complaint that the markets of Nyangwe, Zanzibar, and the Lake District had been invaded by Speke and Grant and others, and although they congratulated each other that the western provinces had not yet been much persecuted, they confessed that now that the travelling epidemic had begun to rage, there was no telling how soon a lot of European and American busybodies might be among them. Thedepo at Kasange and Bihe had both been visited, and although Kazonde had hitherto been left quiet, there are rumours enough that the continent was to be tramped over from east to west. [Footnote: This extraordinary feat was, it is universally known, subsequently accomplished by Cameron. "And it may be," continued Alvez, "that that missionary fellow, Livingston, is already on his way to us. If he comes, there can be but one result. There must be freedom for all slaves in Kazonnde." "Freedom for the slaves in Kazonnde?" These were the words with which, in connection with Dr. Livingstone's name, had arrested Mrs. Weldon's attention, and who can wonder that she pondered them over and over again, and ventured to associate them with her own prospects? Here was a ray of hope. The mere mention of Livingstone's name in association with this story seems to demand a brief survey of his career. Born on the 19th of March, 1813, David Livingstone was the second of six children of a tradesman in the village of Blantyre in Lanarkshire. After 2 years' training in medicine and theology, he was sent out by the London Missionary Society and landed at the Cape of Good Hope in 1840, with the intention of joining Moffat in South Africa. After exploring the country of the Bechuanas, he returned to Kuruman, and having married Moffat's daughter, proceeded in 1843 to found a mission in the Mabotsa Valley. After 4 years, he removed to Kolobeng, in the Bechuana district, 225 miles north of Kuruman, whence, in 1849, starting off with his wife, three children, and two friends, Mr. Oswald and Mr. Murray, he discovered Lake Ngami, and returned by descending the course of the Zuga. The opposition of the natives had prevented his proceeding beyond Lake Ngami at his first visit, and he made a second with no better success. In a third attempt, however, he wended his way northwards with his family and Mr. Oswell along the Chobe, an affluent of the Zambezi, and after a difficult journey at length reached the district of the Makalolos, of whom the chief, named Sebetwane, joined him at Linyante. The Zambezi itself was discovered at the end of June, 1851, and the doctor returned to the Cape for the purpose of sending his family to England. His next project was to cross the continent obliquely from south to west, but in this expedition he had resolved that he would risk no life but his own. Accompanied, therefore, by only a few natives, he started in the following June, and skirting the Kalahari Desert, entered Litubaruba on the last day of the year. Here he found the Bechuana district, much ravaged by the Boers, the original Dutch colonists, who had formed the population of the Cape before it came into possession of the English. After a fortnight's stay, he proceeded into the heart of the district of the Bamangonatos, and travelled continuously until the 23rd of May, when he arrived at Linyante, and was received with much honour by Sekeletu, who had recently become sovereign of the Makalolos. A severe attack of fever detained the traveller here for a period, but he made good use of the enforced rest by studying the manners of the country, and became for the first time sensible of its terrible sufferings in consequence of the slave trade. Descending the course of the Chobe to the Zambezi, he next entered Naniele, and after visiting Katonga and Libonta, advanced to the point of confluence of the Liva with the Zambezi, where he determined upon ascending the former as far as the Portuguese possessions in the west. It was an undertaking, however, that required considerable preparation, so that it was necessary for him to return to Linyante. On the 11th of November he started again. He was accompanied by 27 Makalolos, and ascended the Liva Till, in the territory of the Balonda. Here he reached a spot where it received the waters of his tributary, the Makondo. It was the first time a white man had ever penetrated so far. Proceeding on their way, they arrived at the residence of Shinte, the most powerful of the chieftains of the Balonda, by whom they were well received, and having met with equal kindness from Katima, a ruler on the other side of Lemba, they encamped, on the 20th of February, 1853, on the banks of Lake Dilolo. Here it was that the real difficulty commenced, the arduous travelling, the attacks on the natives, and their exorbitant demands. The conspiracies of his own attendants and their desertions would soon have caused any one of less energy to abandon his enterprise. But David Livingstone was not a man to be daunted. Resolutely he persevered, and on the 4th of April reached the banks of the Coango, the stream that forms the frontier of the Portuguese possessions, and joins the Zaire on the north. 6 days later he passed through Kasange. Here it was that Alvez had seen him. On the 31st of May he arrived at St. Paul de Luanda, having traversed this continent in about 2 years. It was not long, however, before he was off again, following the banks of the Coanza, the river which was to bring such trying experiences to Dick Sands and his party. He reached the Lumbe, and having met numbers of slave caravans on his way, again passed through Kasange, crossed the Coango, and reached the Zambezi at Kewawa. By the 8th of the following June he was again at Lake Dilolo, and descending the river he re-entered Linyante. Here he stayed till the 3rd of November, where he commenced his second great journey, which was to carry him completely across Africa, from west to east. After visiting the famed Victoria Falls, the intrepid explorer quitted the Zambezi and took a northeasterly route, the transit of the territory of the Patokas, a people brutalized by the inhalation of hemp, a visit to Simalimboni, the powerful chief of the district, the passage of the Kafoni, a visit to King Mburuma, an inspection of the ruins of Zumbo, an old Portuguese town, a meeting with the chief Mpende, at that time at war with the Portuguese, these were the principal events of this journey. And on the 22nd of April, Livingstone left Tete, and having descended this river as far as its delta, reached Kilimane, just 4 years after his departure from the Cape. On the 12th of July he embarked for the Mauritius, and on the 22nd of December, 1856, he landed in England after an absence of 16 years. Loaded with honors by the geographical societies of London and Paris, brilliantly entertained by all ranks, it would have been no matter of surprise if he had surrendered himself to a well-earned repose, but no thought of permanent rest occurred to him, and on the 1st of March, 1858, accompanied by his brother Charles, Captain Bedingfield, Dr. Cook, Dr. Miller, Mr. Thornton, and Mr. Baines, he started again, with the intention of exploring the basin of the Zambezi, and arrived in due time at the coast of Mozambique. The party ascended the great river by the Congoan mouth. They were on board a small steamer named the Ma Robert, and reached Tete on the 8th of September. During the following year, they investigated the lower course of the Zambezi and its left affluent, the Shire, and having visited Lake Shirwa, they explored the territory of the Manganyas and discovered Lake Nyasa. In August 1860, they returned to the Victoria Falls. Early in the following year, Bishop Mackenzie and his missionary staff arrived at the mouth of the Zambezi. In March, an exploration of the Rovuma was made on board the Pioneer, the exploring party returning afterwards to Lake Nyasa, where they remained a considerable time. The 30th of January, 1862, was signalized by the arrival of Mrs. Livingstone, and by the addition of another steamer, the Lady Nyasa, but the happiness of reunion was very transient. It was but a short time before the enthusiastic Bishop Mackenzie succumbed to the unhealthiness of the climate, and on the 27th of April, Mrs. Livingstone expired in her husband's arms. A second investigation of the Rovuma soon followed, and at the end of November, the doctor returned to the Zambezi and reascended the Shire. In the spring of 1803, he lost his companion, Mr. Thornton, and as his brother and Dr. Kurt were both much debilitated, he insisted upon their return to Europe, while he himself returned for the third time to Lake Nyasa and completed the hydrological survey which already he had begun. A few months later, once more found him at the mouth of the Zambezi. Thence he crossed over to Zanzibar, and after 5 years' absence arrived in London, where he published his work, The Exploration of the Zambezi and Its Affluents. Still unwearied and insatiable in his longings, he was back again in Zanzibar at the commencement of 1866, ready to begin his fourth journey, this time attended only by a few sepoys and negroes, witnessing on his way some horrible scenes which were perpetrated as the result of the prosecution of the slave trade. He proceeded to Makolose, on the shores of Lake Nyasa, where nearly all his attendants deserted him, and returned to Zanzibar with the report that he was dead. Dr. Livingstone, meanwhile, was not only alive, but undaunted in his determination to visit the country between the two lakes Nyasa and Tanganyika. With none to guide him except a few natives, he crossed the Loangona, and in the following April discovered Lake Liemba. Here he lay for a whole month, hovering between life and death, but rallying a little, he pushed on the north shore of Lake Moero. Taking up his quarters at Kazambe for 6 weeks, he made two separate explorations of the lake, and then started farther northwards, intending to reach Ujiji, an important town upon Lake Tanganyika. Overtaken, however, by floods, and again abandoned by his servants, he was obliged to retrace his steps. 6 weeks afterwards, he had made his way southwards to the great lake Bangweolo, whence once more he started towards Tanganyika. This last effort was most trying, and the doctor had grown so weak that he was obliged to be carried, but he reached Ujiji, where he was gratified by finding some supplies that had been thoughtfully forwarded to him by the Oriental Society at Calcutta. His great aim now was to ascend the lake and reach the sources of the Nile. On the 21st of September he was at Bambare, in the country of the cannibal Manyuema, upon the Lualaba, the river afterwards ascertained by Stanley to be the Upper Zaire or Congo. At Mamobela the doctor was ill for 24 days, tended only by 3 followers who continued faithful, but in July he made a vigorous effort, and although he was reduced to a skeleton, made his way back to Ujiji. During this long time no tidings of Livingstone reached Europe, and many were the misgivings lest the rumours of his death were only too true. He was himself, too, almost despairing as to receiving any help, but help was closer at hand than he thought. On the 3rd of November, only 11 days after his return to Ujiji, some gunshots were heard within half a mile of the lake. The doctor went out to ascertain whence they proceeded, and had not gone far before a white man stood before him. "You are Dr. Livingstone, I presume," said the stranger, raising his cap. "Yes, sir, I am Dr. Livingstone, and I am happy to see you," answered the doctor, smiling kindly. The two shook each other warmly by the hand. The new arrival was Henry Stanley, the correspondent of the New York Herald, who had been sent out by Mr. Bennett, the editor, in search of the great African explorer. On receiving his orders in October 1870, without a day's unnecessary delay, it embarked at Bombay for Zanzibar, and after a journey involving considerable peril, had arrived safely at Ujiji. Very soon the two travellers found themselves on the best of terms, and set out together on an excursion to the north of Tanganyika. They proceeded as far as Cape Magala, and decided that the chief outlet of the lake must be an affluent of the Lualaba, a conclusion that was subsequently confirmed by Cameron. Towards the end of the year, Stanley began to prepare to return. Livingstone accompanied him as far as Quijada, and on the 3rd of the following March, they parted. "You have done for me what few men would venture to do. I am truly grateful," said Livingstone. Stanley could scarcely repress his tears as he expressed his hope that the doctor might be spared to return to his friends safe and well. "Goodbye," said Stanley, choked with emotion. "Goodbye," answered the veteran feebly. Thus they parted, and in July 1872, Stanley had landed at Marseilles. Again David Livingstone resumed his researches in the interior. After remaining 5 months at Kwihara, he gathered together a retinue consisting of his faithful followers, Susie, Chuma, Amoda, and Jacob Wainwright, and 56 men sent to him by Stanley, and lost no time in proceeding towards the south of Tanganyika. In the course of the ensuing month, the caravan encountered some frightful storms, but succeeded in reaching Mura. They had previously been in extreme drought, which was now followed by the rainy season, which entailed the loss of many of the beasts of burden, in consequence of the bites of the tsetse. On the 24th of January, they were at Chitunque, and in April, after rounding the east of Lake Bangweolo, they made their way towards the village of Chitambo. At this point it was that Livingstone had parted company with certain slave dealers, who had carried the information to old Alves that the missionary traveller would very likely proceed by way of Luanda to Kazonde. By the 13th of June, the very day before Negoro reckoned on obtaining from Mrs. Weldon the letter which should be the means of securing him $100,000, tidings were circulated in the district that on the 1st of May, Dr. Livingstone had breathed his last. The report proved perfectly true. On the 29th of April, the caravan had reached the village of Chitambo, the doctor so unwell that he was carried on a litter. The following night he was in great pain, and after repeatedly murmuring in a low voice, "Oh dear, oh dear," he fell into a kind of stupor. A short time afterwards he called up Susie, and having asked for some medicine, told his attendant that he should not require anything more. "You can go now." At about 4 o'clock next morning, when an anxious visit was made to his room, the doctor was found kneeling by his bedside, his head in his hands, in the attitude of prayer. Susie touched him, but his forehead was icy with the coldness of death. He had died in the night. His body was carried by those who loved him, and in spite of many obstacles was brought to Zanzibar, whence, 9 months after his death, it was conveyed to England. On the 12th of April, 1874, it was interred in Westminster Abbey, counted worthy to be deposited among those whom the country most delights to honour. End of Part the Second, Chapter 14. Recording by Alex C. Talander, Davis, California. www.alexctalander.com. Part the Second, Chapter 15 of Dick Sands, the Boy Captain. This is the LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alex C. Talander, Davis, California. Dick Sands, the Boy Captain, by Jules Verne, translated by Ellen E. Furrer. Part the Second, Chapter 15, An Exciting Chase. To say the truth, it was the very vaguest of hopes to which Mrs. Weldon had been clinging, yet it was not without some thrill of disappointment that she heard from the lips of old Alves himself that Dr. Livingstone had died at a little village on Lake Bangweolo. There had appeared to be a sort of link binding her to the civilized world, but it was now abruptly snapped, and nothing remained for her but to make what terms she could with the base and heartless Negoro. On the 14th, the day appointed for the interview, he made his appearance at the hut, firmly resolved to make no abatement in the terms that he had proposed, Mrs. Weldon on her part being equally determined not to yield to the demand. "There is only one condition," she avowed, "upon which I will acquiesce. My husband shall not be required to come up the country here." Negoro hesitated. At length he said that he would agree to her husband being taken by ship to Mossamedes, a small port in the south of Angola, much frequented by slavers, whither also, at a date hereafter to be fixed, Alvarez should send herself with Jack and Benedict. The stipulation was confirmed that the ransom should be $100,000, and it was further made part of the contract that Negoro should be allowed to depart as an honest man. Mrs. Weldon felt she had gained an important point in thus sparing her husband the necessity of a journey to Kazonde, and had no apprehensions about herself on her way to Mossamedes, knowing that it was to the interest of Alvarez and Negoro alike to attend carefully to her wants. Upon the terms of the covenant being thus arranged, Mrs. Weldon wrote such a letter to her husband as she knew would bring him with all speed to Mossamedes, but she left it entirely to Negoro to represent himself in whatever light he chose. Once in possession of the document, Negoro lost no time in starting on his errand. The very next morning, taking with him about 20 negroes, he set off towards the north, alleging to Alvarez as his motive for taking that direction that he was not only going to embark somewhere at the mouth of the Congo, but that he was anxious to keep as far as possible from the prison houses of the Portuguese, with which already he had been involuntarily only too familiar. After his departure, Mrs. Weldon resolved to make the best of her period for imprisonment, aware that it could hardly be less than 4 months before he would return. She had no desire to go beyond the precincts assigned her, even had the privilege been allowed her, but warned by Negoro that Hercules was still free, and might at any time attend to rescue. Alvarez had no thought of permitting her any unnecessary liberty. Her life therefore soon resumed its previous monotony. The daily routine went on within the enclosure pretty much as in other parts of the town, the women all being employed in various labors for the benefit of their husbands and masters. The rice was pounded with wooden pestles, the maize was peeled and winnowed, previously to extracting the granular substance for the drink which they call mtele. The sorghum had to be gathered in, the season of its ripening being marked by festive observances. There was a fragrant oil, to be expressed from a kind of olive named the umpafu. The cotton had to be spun on spindles, which were hardly less than a foot and a half in length. There was the bark of trees to be woven into textures for wearing. The manioc had to be dug up, and the cassava procured from its roots. Beside all this, there was the preparation of the soil for its future plantings, the usual productions of the country being the moritsane beans, grown in pots 15 inches long upon stems 20 feet high, the arachides, for which they procure a serviceable oil, the chilobe pea, the blossoms of which are used to give a flavor to the insipid sorghum, the cucumbers, of which the seeds are roasted on as chestnuts, as well as the common crops of coffee, sugar, onions, guavas, and sesame. To the woman's lot, too, falls the manipulation of all the fermented drinks, the malafu, made from bananas, the pombe, and various other liquors. Nor should the care of the domestic animals be forgotten, the cows that would not allow themselves to be milked unless they can see their calf, or a stuffed representative of it, the short-horned heifers that not unfrequently have a hump, the goats that, like slaves, form part of the currency of the country, the pigs, the sheep, and the poultry. The men, meanwhile, smoke their hemp or tobacco, hunt buffaloes or elephants, or are hired by the dealers to join in the slave raids. The harvest of slaves, in fact, being a thing of as regular and periodic recurrence as the ingathering of the maize. In her daily strolls, Mrs. Weldon would occasionally pause to watch the women, but they only responded to her notice by a long stare or by a hideous grimace. A kind of natural instinct made them hate a white skin, and they had no spark of commiseration for the stranger who had been brought among them. Halima, however, was a marked exception. She grew more and more devoted to her mistress, and by degrees the two became able to exchange many sentences in the native dialect. Jack generally accompanied his mother. Naturally enough, he longed to get outside the enclosure, but still he found considerable amusement in watching the birds that built in a huge baobab that grew within. There were the marabous, making their nests with twigs. There were scarlet-throated suimangas, with nests like weaver birds, widow birds that helped themselves liberally to the thatch of the huts, calaos, with their tuneful song, grey parrots with bright red tails, called roofs by the manuema, who apply the same name to the reigning chiefs, and insect-eating drongos, like grey linnets with large red beaks. Hundreds of butterflies flitted about, especially in the neighbourhood of the brooks, but these were more to the taste of Cousin Benedict than of little Jack. Over and over again the child expressed his regret that he could not see over the walls, and more than ever he seemed to miss his friend Dick, who had taught him to climb a mast, and who was sure would have fine fun with him in the branches of the trees, which were growing sometimes to the height of 100 feet. So long as the supply of insects did not fail, Benedict would have been contented to stay on without a murmur in his present quarters. True, without his glasses he worked at a disadvantage, but he had had the good fortune to discover a minute bee that forms its cells in the holes of worm-eaten wood, and a sphex that practices the craft of the cuckoo, and deposits its eggs in an abode not prepared by itself. Mosquitoes abounded in swarms, and the worthy naturalist was so covered by their stings as to be hardly recognizable. But when Mrs. Weldon remonstrated with him for exposing himself so unnecessarily, he merely scratched the irritated places on his skin and said, "It is their instinct, you know, it is their instinct." On the 17th of June, an adventure happened to him which was attended with unexpected consequences. It was about 11 o'clock in the morning. The insufferable heat had driven all the residents within the depot indoors, and not a native was to be seen in the streets of Kazonde. Mrs. Weldon was dozing. Jack was fast asleep. Benedict himself, sorely against his will, for he heard the hum of many an insect in the sunshine, had been driven to the seclusion of his cabin, and was falling into an involuntary siesta. Suddenly a buzz was heard, an insect's wing vibrating some 15,000 beats a second. "A hexapod!" cried Benedict, sitting up. Short-sighted though he was, his hearing was acute, and his perception made him thoroughly convinced that he was in proximity to some giant specimen of its kind. Without moving from his seat, he did his utmost to ascertain what it was. He was determined not to flinch from the sharpest of stings if only he could get the chance of capturing it. Presently he made out a large black speck flitting about in the few rays of daylight that were allowed to penetrate the hut. With bated breath he waited in eager expectation. The insect, after long hovering above him, finally settled on his head. A smile of satisfaction played about his lips as he felt it, crawling lightly through his hair. Equally fearful of missing or injuring it, he restrained his first impulse to grasp it in his hand. "I will wait a minute," he thought. "Perhaps it may creep down my nose. By his squint a little, perhaps I shall be able to see it." For some moments hope alternated with fear. There sat Benedict with what he persuaded himself was some new African hexapod perched upon his head, and agitated by doubts as to the direction in which it would move. Instead of travelling in the way he reckoned along his nose, might it not crawl behind his ears, or down his neck, or worse than all, resume its flight in the air? Fortune seemed inclined to favour him. After threading the entanglement of the naturalist's hair, the insect felt to be descending to his forehead. With a fortitude not unworthy of the Spartan, who suffered his breast to be gnawed by a fox, nor the Roman hero who plunged his hand into the red-hot coals, Benedict endured the tickling of the 6 small feet, and made not a motion that might frighten the creature into taking wing. After making repeated circuits of his forehead, it passed just between his eyebrows. There was a moment of deep suspense, lest it should once more go upwards, but it soon began to move again. Neither to the right nor to the left did it turn, but kept straight on over the furrows made by the constant rubbing of the spectacles, right along the arch of the cartilage, till it reached the extreme tip of the nose. Like a couple of movable lenses, Benedict's 2 eyes steadily turned themselves inwards till they were directed to the proper point. "Good," he whispered to himself. He was exulting at the discovery that what he had been waiting for so patiently was a rare specimen of the tribe of the Cicindelidae, peculiar to the districts of southern Africa. "A tuberous manticora!" he exclaimed. The insect began to move again, and as it crawled down to the entrance of the nostrils, the tickling sensation became too much for endurance, and Benedict sneezed. He made a sudden clutch, but of course he only caught his own nose. His vexation was very great, but he did not lose his composure. He knew that the manticora rarely flies very high, and the more frequently than not it simply crawls. Accordingly he groped about a long time on his hands and knees, and at last he found it basking in a ray of sunshine within a foot of him. His resolution was soon taken. He would not run the risk of crushing it by trying to catch it, but would make his observations on it as it crawled. And so, with his nose close to the ground, like a dog upon the scent, he followed it on all fours, admiring and examining it as it moved. Regardless of the heat, he not only left the doorway of his hut, but continued creeping along till he reached the enclosing palisade. At the foot of the fence the manticore, according to the habits of his kind, began to seek a subterranean retreat, and coming to the opening of a mole track, entered it at once. Benedict quite thought he had now lost sight of his prize altogether, but his surprise was very great when he found that the aperture was at least 2 feet wide, and that it led into a gallery which would admit his whole body. His momentary feeling of astonishment, however, gave way to his eagerness to follow up the hexapod, and he continued burrowing like a ferret. Without knowing it, he actually passed under the palisading and was now beyond. The mole track, in fact, was a communication that had been made between the interior and exterior of the enclosure. Benedict had obtained his freedom, but so far from caring in the least for his liberty, he continued totally absorbed in the pursuit upon which he had started. He watched with unflagging vigilance, as it was only when the hexapod expanded its wings as if for flight that he prepared to imprison it in the hollow of his hand. All at once, however, he was taken by surprise. A whiz and a whir, and the prize was gone. Disappointed rather than despairing, Benedict raised himself up and looked about him. Before long, the old black speck was again flitting just above his head. There was every reason to hope that it would ultimately settle once more upon the ground. But on this side of the palisade there was a large forest a little way to the north, and if the manticora were to get into that massive foliage, all hope of keeping it in view would be lost, and there would be an end of the proud expectation of storing it in the tin box, to be preserved among the rest of the entomological wonders. After a while the insect descended to the earth. It did not rest at all, nor crawl as it had done previously, but made its advance by a series of rapid hops. This made the chase for the near-sighted naturalist a matter of great difficulty. He put his face as close to the ground as possible, and kept starting off and stopping and starting off again, with his arms extended like a swimming frog, continually making frantic clutches to find as continuously that his grasp had been eluded. After running till he was out of breath, and scratching his hands against the brushwood and the foliage till they bled, he had the mortification of feeling the insect dash past his ear with what might be a defiant buzz, and finding that it was out of sight forever. "Ungrateful hexapod!" he cried in dismay. "I intended to honor you with the best place in my collection." He knew not what to do, and could not reconcile himself to the loss. He reproached himself for not having secured the manticora at the first. He gazed at the forest, till he persuaded himself he could see the coveted insect in the distance, and seized with a frantic impulse, exclaimed, "I will have you yet!" He did not even yet realize the fact that he had gained his liberty, but heedless of everything except his own burning disappointment, and at the risk of being attacked by natives or beset by wild beasts, he was just on the very point of dashing into the heart of the wood, when suddenly a giant form confronted him. As suddenly a giant had seized him by the neck, and lifting him up, carried him off with apparently as little exertion as he could himself have carried off his hexapod. For that day at least, Cousin Benedict had lost his chance of being the happiest of entomologists. End of Part the Second, Chapter 15. Recording by Alex Hetelander, Davis, California. www.alexhetelander.com. Part the Second, Chapter 16 of Dick Sands, the Boy Captain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alex Hetelander, Davis, California. Dick Sands, the Boy Captain, by Jules Verne, translated by Ellen E. Frewer. Part the Second, Chapter 16, A Magician. On finding that Cousin Benedict did not return to his quarters at the proper hour, Mrs. Weldon began to feel uneasy. She could not imagine what had become of him. His tin box with its contents were safe in his hut, and even if a chance of escape had been offered him, she knew that nothing would have induced him voluntarily to abandon his treasures. She enlisted the services of Halima, and spent the remainder of the day in searching for him, until at last she felt herself driven to the conviction that he must have been confirmed by the orders of Alvez himself. For what reason she could not divine, as Benedict had undoubtedly been included in the number of prisoners to be delivered to Mr. Weldon for the stipulated ransom. But the rage of the traitor, when he heard of the escape of the captive, was an ample proof that he had had no hand in his disappearance. A rigorous search was instituted in every direction, which resulted in the discovery of the mole track. Here beyond a question was the passage through which the flycatcher had found his way. "Idiot! Fool! Rascal!" muttered Alvez, full of rage at the prospect of losing a portion of the redemption money. "If ever I get a hold of him, he shall pay dearly for this freak." The opening was at once blocked. The woods were scoured all round for a considerable distance, but no trace of Benedict was to be found. Mrs. Weldon was bitterly grieved and much overcome, but she had no alternative except to resign herself, as best she could, to the loss of her unfortunate relation. There was a tinge of bitterness in her anxiety, for she could not help being irritated at the recklessness with which he had withdrawn himself from the reach of her protection. Meanwhile, the weather for the time of year underwent a very unusual change. Although the rainy season is ordinarily reckoned to terminate about the end of April, the sky had suddenly become overcast in the middle of June. Rain had recommenced falling, and the downpour had been so heavy and continuous that all the ground was thoroughly sodden. To Mrs. Weldon personally, this incessant rainfall brought no other inconvenience beyond depriving her of her daily exercise. But to the natives in general it was a very serious calamity. The ripening crops in the low-lying districts were completely flooded, and the inhabitants feared that they would be reduced to the greatest extremities. All agricultural pursuits had come to a standstill, and neither the Queen nor her ministers could devise any expedient to avert or mitigate the misfortune. They resolved at last to have recourse to the magicians, not those who were called in request to heal diseases or to procure good luck, but to the Umganga, sorcerers of a superior order, who were credited with the faculty of invoking or dispelling rain. But it was all to no purpose. It was in vain that the Umganga monotoned their incantations, flourished their rattles, jingled their bills, and exhibited their amulets, it was equally without avail that they rolled up their balls of dirt and spat in the faces of all the courtiers. The pitiless rain continued to descend, and the malign influences that were rolling the clouds refused to be propitiated. The prospect seemed to become more and more hopeless when the report was brought to Moena that there was a most wonderful Mganga resident in the north of Angola. He had never been seen in this part of the country, but fame declared him to be a magician of the very highest order. Application, without delay, should be made to him, and he surely would be able to stay the rain. Early in the morning of the 25th, a great tinkling of bells announced the magician's arrival at Kazonde. The natives poured out to meet him on his way to the Chitoka, their minds being already predisposed in his favour by a moderation of the downpour, and by sundry indications of a coming change of wind. The ordinary practice of the professors of the magical art is to perambulate the villages in parties of three or four, accompanied by a considerable number of acolytes and assistants. In this case the Mganga came entirely alone. He was a pure negro of most imposing stature, more than 6 feet high, and broad in proportion. All over his chest was a fantastic pattern traced in pipe clay, the lower portion of his body being covered with a flowing skirt of woven grass, so long that it made a train. Round his neck hung a string of bird skulls. Upon his head he wore a leathern helmet, ornamented with pearls and plumes, and about his waist was a copper girdle, to which was attached bells that tinkled like the harness of a Spanish mule. The only instrument indicating his art was a basket he carried made of a calabash containing shells, amulets, little wooden idols, and other fetishes, together with what was more important than all, a large number of those balls of dung, without which no African ceremony of divination could ever be complete. One peculiarity was soon discovered by the crowd. The Mganga was dumb, and could utter only one low, guttural sound, which was quite unintelligible. This was a circumstance, however, that seemed only to augment their faith in his power. With a stately strut that brought all his tinkling paraphernalia into full play, the magician proceeded to make the circuit of the marketplace. The natives followed in a troop behind, endeavouring, like monkeys, to imitate his every movement. He turned into the main thoroughfare, and began to make his way direct to the royal residence, whence, as soon as the queen heard of his approach, she advanced to meet him. On seeing her, the Mganga bowed to the very dust, then rearing himself to his full height, he pointed aloft, and by the significance of his animated gestures, indicated that, although the fleeting clouds were now going to the west, they would soon return eastwards with a rotary motion irresistibly strong. All at once, to the surprise of the beholders, he stooped and took the hand of the mighty sovereign of Kazonde. The courtiers hurried forward to check the unprecedented breach of etiquette, but the foremost was driven back with so staggering a blow that the others deemed it prudent to retire. The queen herself appeared not to take the least offence at the familiarity. She bestowed a hideous grimace, which was meant for a smile, upon her illustrious visitor, who, still keeping his hold upon her hand, started off walking at a rapid pace, the crowd following in the rear. He directed his steps towards the residence of Alves, and finding the door closed, applied his strong shoulder to it with such effect that it fell bodily to the ground, and the passive sovereign stood within the limits of the enclosure. The traitor was about to summon his slaves and soldiers to repel the unceremonious invasion of his premises, but on beholding the queen, all stepped back with respectful reverence. Before Alves had time to ask the sovereign to what cause he was indebted for the honour of her visit, the magician had cleared a wide space around him, and had once again commenced his performances. Brandishing his arms wildly, he pointed to the clouds as though he were arresting them in their course. He inflated his huge cheeks and blew with all his strength, as if resolved to disperse the heavy masses, and then stretching himself to his full height, he appeared to clutch them in his giant grasp. Deeply impressed, the superstitious Moena was a half beside herself with excitement. She uttered loud cries and involuntarily began herself to imitate every one of the Mganga's gestures. The entire crowd joined in, and very soon the low, guttural note of the sorcerer was lost, totally drowned in the turmoil of howls, shrieks, and discordant songs. To the chagrin, however, both of the queen and her subjects, there was not the slightest intimation that the clouds above were going to permit a rift by which the rays of the tropical sun could find a passage. On the contrary, the tokens of improvement in the weather, which had been observed in the early morning, had all disappeared. The atmosphere was darker than ever, and heavy storm drops began to patter down. A reaction was beginning to take place in the enthusiasm of the crowd. After all, then, it would seem that this famous Mganga, from whom so much had been expected, had no power above the rest. Disappointment every moment grew more keen, and soon there was a positive display of irritation. The natives pressed around him with closed fists and threatening gestures. A frown gathered on Moena's face, and her lips opened with muttered words clear enough to make the magician understand that his ears were in jeopardy. His position was evidently becoming critical. An unexpected incident suddenly altered the aspects of affairs. The Mganga was quite tall enough to see over the heads of the crowd, and all at once, poising in the midst of his incantations, he pointed to a distant corner of the enclosure. All eyes were instantly turned in that direction. Mrs. Weldon and Jack had just come out of their hut, and catching sight of them, the Mganga stood with his left hand pointing towards them, and his right upstretched towards the heavens. Intuitively, the multitude comprehended his meaning. Here was the explanation of the mystery. It was this white woman with her child that had been the cause of all their misery. It was owing to them that the clouds had poured down this desolating rain. With yells of execration, the whole mob made a dash towards the unfortunate lady, who, pale with fright and rigid as a statue, stood clasping her boy to her side. The Mganga, however, anticipated them. Having pushed his way through the infuriated throng, he seized the child and held him high in the air, as though about to hurl him to the ground, a peace-offering to the offended gods. Mrs. Weldon gave a piercing shriek, and fell senseless to the earth. Lifting her up and making a sign to the queen that all would now be right, the Mganga retreated carrying both mother and child through the crowd, who retreated before him and made an open passage. Alvarez now felt that it was time to interfere. Already one of his prisoners had eluded his vigilance, and was he now to see two more carried off before his eyes? Was he to lose the whole of the expected ransom? No, rather would he see Kazonde destroyed by a deluge than resign his chance of securing so good a prize. Darting forwards, he attempted to stop the magician's progress, but public opinion was against him. At a sign from the queen, he was seized by the guards, and he was aware well enough of what would be the immediate consequence of resistance. He deemed it prudent to desist from his obstruction, but in his heart he bitterly cursed the stupid credulity of the natives for supposing that the blood of the white woman or the child could avail to put an end to the disasters they were suffering. Making the natives understand that they were not to follow him, the magician carried off his burden as easily as a lion would carry a couple of kids. The lady was still unconscious, and Jack was all but paralyzed with fright. Once free of the enclosure, the Mganga crossed the town, entered the forest, and after a march of 3 miles, during which he did not slacken his pace for a moment, reached the bank of a river which was flowing towards the north. Here in the cavity of a rock, concealed by drooping foliage, a canoe was moored, covered with a kind of thatched roof. On this the magician deposited his burden, and sending the light craft into midstream with a vigorous kick, exclaimed in a jeery voice, "Here they are, Captain, both of them, Mrs. Weldon and Master Jack, both. We will be off now. I hope those idiots of Kazonde will have plenty more rain yet. Off we go." End of part the second, chapter 16. Recording by Alex Hetalander, Davis, California. www.alexhetalander.com. Part the second, chapter 17 of Dick Sands, the Boy Captain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alex Hetalander, Davis, California. Dick Sands, the Boy Captain, by Jules Verne, translated by Ellen E. Frewer. Part the second, chapter 17, Drifting Down the Stream. "Off we go!" It was the voice of Hercules addressing Dick Sands, who, frightfully but debilitated by recent sufferings, was leaning against Cousin Benedict for support. Dingo was lying at his feet. Mrs. Weldon gradually recovered her consciousness. Looking around her in amazement, she caught sight of Dick. "Dick! Is it you?" she muttered feebly. The lad with some difficulty arose and took her hand in his, while Jack overwhelmed him with kisses. "And who would have thought it was you, Hercules, that carried us away?" said the child. "I did not know you a bit. You were so dreadfully ugly." "I was a sort of a devil, you know, Master Jack," Hercules answered, "and the devil is not particularly handsome," and he began rubbing his chest vigorously to get rid of the white pattern with which he had adorned it. Mrs. Weldon held out her hand to him with a grateful smile. "Yes, Mrs. Weldon, he has saved you, and although he does not own it, he has saved me too," said Dick. "Saved," repeated Hercules. "You must not talk about safety, for you are not saved yet." And pointing to Benedict, he continued, "That's where your thanks are due. Unless he had come and informed me all about you and where you were, I should have known nothing, and should have been powerless to aid you." It was now 5 days since he had fallen in with the entomologist, as he was chasing the manticore, and unceremoniously had carried him off. As the canoe drifted rapidly along the stream, Hercules briefly related his adventures since his escape from the encampment on the Kwanza. He described how he had followed the Kitanda, which was conveying Mrs. Weldon, how in the course of his march he had found Dingo badly wounded, how he and the dog together had reached the neighbourhood of Kazonde, and how he had contrived to send a note to Dick, intending to inform him of Mrs. Weldon's destination. Then he went on to say that his unexpected rencontre With Cousin Benedict, he had watched very closely for a chance to get into the guarded depot, but until now had entirely failed. A celebrated Mganga had been passing on his way through the forest, and he had resolved upon impersonating him as a means of gaining the admittance he wanted. His strength made the undertaking sufficiently easy, and having stripped the magician of his paraphernalia and bound him securely to a tree, he painted his own body with a pattern like that which he observed on his victim's chest, and having attired himself with the magical garments, was quite equipped to impose upon the credulous natives. The result of this stratagem they had all that day witnessed. He had hardly finished his account of himself when Mrs. Weldon, smiling at his success, turned to Dick. "And how, all this time, my dear boy, has it fared with you?" she asked. Dick said, "I remember very little to tell you. I recollect being fastened to a stake in the river bed, and the water rising and rising till it was above my head. My last thoughts were about yourself and Jack. Then everything became a blank, and I knew nothing more until I found myself among the papyrus on the river bank, with Hercules tending me like a nurse." "You see, I am the right sort of Mganga," interposed Hercules. "I am a doctor as well as a conjurer. But tell me, Hercules, how did you save him?" "Oh, it was not a difficult matter by any means," answered Hercules modestly. "It was dark, you know, so that at the proper moment it was quite possible to wade in amongst the poor wretches at the bottom of the trench, and to wrench the stake from its socket. Anybody could have done it. Cousin Benedict could have done it. Dingo, too, might have done it. Perhaps, after all, it was Dingo that did it." "No, no, Hercules, that won't do," cried Jack. "Besides, look, Dingo is shaking his head. He's telling you he didn't do it." "Dingo must not tell tales, Master Jack," said Hercules, laughing. But nevertheless, although the brave fellow's modesty prompted him to conceal it, it was clear that he had accomplished a daring feat, of which few would have ventured to incur the risk. Inquiry was next made after Tom, Bat, Actaeon, and Austin. His countenance fell, and large tears gathered in his eyes as Hercules told how he had seen them pass through the forest in a slave caravan. They were gone. He feared they were gone forever. Mrs. Walden tried to console him with the hope that they might still be spared to meet again some day, but he shook his head mournfully. She then communicated to Dick the terms of the compact that had been entered into for her own release, and observed that under the circumstances it might really have been more prudent for her to remain in Kazonde. "Then I have made a mistake. I have been an idiot in bringing you away," said Hercules, ever ready to depreciate his own actions. "No," said Dick, "you have made no mistake. You could not have done better. Those rascals, 10 chances to 1, will only get Mr. Weldon into some trap. We must get to Mossamedes before Negoro arrives. Once there, we shall find that the Portuguese authorities will lend us their protection, and when old Alves arrives to claim his $100,000, he shall receive a good thrashing for his pains," said Hercules, finishing Dick's sentence and chuckling heartily at the prospect. It was agreed on all hands that it was most important that Negoro's arrival at Mossamedes should be forestalled. The plan which Dick had so long contemplated of reaching the coast by descending some river seemed now in a fair way of being accomplished, and from the northerly direction in which they were proceeding it was quite probable that they would ultimately reach the Zaire, and in that case not actually arrive at St. Paul de Luanda, but that would be immaterial, as they would be sure of finding help anywhere in the colonies of Lower Guinea. On finding himself on the river bank, Dick's first thought had been to embark upon one of the floating islands that are continually to be seen upon the surface of the African streams, but it happened that Hercules, during one of his rambles, found a native boat that had run adrift. It was just the discovery that suited their need. It was one of the long, narrow canoes, 30 feet in length by 3 or 4 in breadth, that with a large number of paddles can be driven with immense velocity, but by the aid of a single scull can be safely guided down the current of the stream. Dick was somewhat afraid that, to elude observation, it would be necessary to proceed only by night, but as the loss of 12 hours out of the 24 would double the length of the voyage, he devised the plan of covering the canoe with a roof of long grass, supported by a horizontal pole from stem to stern, and this not only afforded a shelter from the sun, but so effectually concealed the craft, rudder, scull, and all, that the very birds mistook it for one of the natural islets, and red-beaked gulls, black aringas, and grey and white kingfishers would frequently alight upon it in search of food. Though comparatively free from fatigue, the voyage must necessarily be long, and by no means free from danger, and the daily supply of provisions was not easy to procure. If fishing failed, Dick had the one gun which Hercules had carried away with him from the anthill, and as he was by no means a bad shot, he hoped to find plenty of game, either along the banks or by firing through a loophole in the thatch. The rate of the current, as far as he could tell, was about 2 miles an hour, enough to carry them about 50 miles a day. It was the speed, however, that made it necessary for them to keep a sharp lookout for any rocks or submerged trunks of trees, as well as to be on their guard against rapids and cataracts. Dick's strength and spirits all revived at the delight of having Mrs. Weldon and Jack restored to him, and he assumed his post at the bow of the canoe, directing Hercules how to use the scull at the stern. A litter of soft grass was made for Mrs. Weldon, who spent most of her time lying thoughtfully in the shade. Cousin Benedict was very taciturn. He had not recovered the loss of the manticora, and frowned ever and again at Hercules, as if he had not yet forgiven him for stopping him in the chase. Jack, who had been told that he must not be noisy, amused himself by playing with Dingo. The first 2 days passed without any special incident. The stock of provisions was quite enough for that time, so that there was no need to disembark, and Dick merely lay for a few hours in the night to take a little necessary repose. The stream nowhere exceeded 150 feet in breadth. The floating islands moved at the same pace as the canoe, and except for some unforeseen circumstance, there could be no apprehension of a collision. The banks were destitute of human inhabitants, but were richly clothed with wild plants, of which the blossoms were the most gorgeous colors. The asclepiae, the gladiolus, the clematis, lilies, aloes, umbelliferae, arborescent ferns, and fragrant shrubs, combining on either hand to make a border of surpassing beauty. Here and there the forest extended to the very shore, and cobalt trees, acacias with their stiff foliage, bohinias, clothed with lichen, fig trees with their masses of pendant roots, and other trees of splendid growth rose to the height of 100 feet, forming a shade which the rays of the sun utterly failed to penetrate. Occasionally a wreath of creepers would form an arch from shore to shore, and on the 27th, to Jack's great delight, a group of monkeys was seen crossing one of these natural bridges, holding on most carefully by their tails, lest the aerial pathway should snap beneath their weight. These monkeys, belonging to a smaller kind of chimpanzee, which are known in Central Africa by the name of sokos, were hideous creatures with low foreheads, bright yellow faces, and long, upright ears. They herd in troops of about 10, bark like dogs, and are much dreaded by the natives on account of their alleged propensity to carry off young children. There is no telling what predatory designs they might have formed against Master Jack if they had spied him out, but Dick's artifice effectually screened him from their observation. 20 miles further on, the canoe came to a sudden standstill. "What's the matter now, Captain?" cried Hercules from the stern. "We have drifted onto a grass barrier, and there is no hope for it. We shall have to cut our way through," answered Dick. "All right, I dare say we shall manage it," promptly replied Hercules, leaving his rudder to come in front. The obstruction was formed by the interlacing of masses of the tough, glossy grass, known by the name of tikatika, which, when compressed, affords a surface so compact and resisting that trellas have been known to, by means of it, to cross rivers dry-footed. Splendid specimens of lotus plants had taken root amongst the vegetation. As it was nearly dark, Hercules could lead the bow without much fear of detection, and so effectually did he wield his hatchet that, in 2 hours after the stoppage, the barrier was hewn asunder, and the light craft resumed the channel. It must be owned that it was with a sense of reluctance that Benedict felt the boat was again beginning to move forward. The whole voyage appeared to him to be perfectly uninteresting and unnecessary. Not a single insect had he observed since he left Kazonde, and his most ardent wish was that he could return there and regain possession of his invaluable tin box. But an unlooked-for gratification was in store for him. Hercules, who had been his pupil long enough to have an eye for the kind of creature Benedict was ever trying to rescue, on coming back from his exertions on the grass barrier, bought a horrible-looking animal and submitted it to the sullen entomologist. "Is this of any use to you?" The amateur lifted it up carefully, and having almost poked it into his near-sighted eyes, uttered a cry of delight. "Bravo, Hercules! You are making amends for your past mischief. It is splendid! It is unique!" "Is it really very curious?" said Mrs. Weldon. "Yes, indeed," answered the enraptured naturalist. "It is really unique. It belongs to neither of the 10 orders. It can be classed neither with the Coleoptera, Neuroptera, nor to the Hymenoptera. If it had 8 legs, I should know how to classify it. I should place it amongst the second section of the Arachnida. But it is a hexapod, a genuine hexapod, a spider with 6 legs, a grand discovery. He must be entered on the catalogue as Hexapodes Benedictus." Once again mounted on his hobby, the worthy enthusiast continued to discourse with an unwonted vivacity to his indulgent, not over-attentive audience. Meanwhile the canoe was steadily threading its way over the dark waters, the silence of the night broken only by the rattle of the scales of some crocodiles, or by the snorting of hippopotamuses in the neighbourhood. Once the travellers were startled by a loud noise, such as might proceed from some ponderous machinery in motion. It was caused by a troop of 100 or more elephants that, after feasting through the day on the roots of the forest, had come to quench their thirst at the riverside. But no danger was to be apprehended. Lighted by the pale moon that rose over the tall trees, the canoe throughout the night pursued in safety its solitary voyage. End of Part the Second, Chapter 17. Recording by Alex C. Talander, Davis, California. www.alexhetalander.com. Part the Second, Chapter 18 of Dick Sands, the Boy Captain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alex Hetalander, Davis, California. Dick Sands, the Boy Captain, by Jules Verne. Recorded by Ellen E. Frewer. Part the Second, Chapter 18. An Anxious Voyage. Thus the canoe drifted on for a week, the forest that for many miles had skirted the river ultimately giving place to extensive jungles that stretched far away to the horizon. Destitute, fortunately for the travellers, of human inhabitants, the district abounded in a large variety of animal life. Zebras, elands, camas sported on the bank, disappearing at nightfall before howling leopards and roaring lions. It was Dick's general custom, as he lay for a while in the afternoon, to go ashore in search of food, and as the manioc, maize, and sorghum that were to be found were of a wild growth, and consequently not fit for consumption, he was obliged to run the risk of using his gun. On the 4th of July he succeeded, by a single shot, in killing poku, a kind of antelope about 5 feet long, with annulated horns, a tawny skin dappled with bright spots, and a white belly. The venison proved excellent, and was roasted over a fire procured by the primitive method, practiced, it is said, even by gorillas, of rubbing two sticks together. In spite of these halts, and the time taken for the night's rest, the distance accomplished by the 8th could not be estimated at less than 100 miles. The river, augmented by only a few insignificant tributaries, had not materially increased in volume. Its direction, however, had slightly changed more to the northwest. It afforded a very fair supply of fish, which were caught by lines made of the long stems of creepers, furnished with thorns instead of fish-hooks, a considerable proportion being the delicate sanjkas, which when dried may be transported to any climate. Besides these were the black usakas, the white-headed mondes, and occasionally the little dagalas, resembling Thames whitebait. Next day, Dick met with an adventure that put all his courage and composure to the test. He had noticed the horns of a kama projecting above the brushwood, and went ashore alone with the intention of securing it. He succeeded in getting tolerably close to it and fired, but he was terribly startled when a formidable creature bounded along some 30 paces ahead and took possession of the prey he had just wounded. It was a majestic lion, at least 5 feet in height, of the kind called karamu, in distinction to the maneless known as the Nyasi lion. Before Dick had time to reload, the huge brute had caught sight of him, and without relaxing his hold upon the writhing antelope beneath its claws, glared upon him fiercely. Dick's presence of mind did not forsake him. Flight, he knew, was not to be thought of. His only chance, he felt intuitively, would be by keeping perfectly still, and aware that the beast would be unlikely to give up a struggling prey for another that was motionless. He stood face to face with his foe, not venturing to move an eyelid. In a few minutes the lion's patience seemed to be exhausted, and with a grand stateliness it picked up the kama as easily as a dog would lift a hare, turned round, and lashing the bushes with its tail, disappeared in the jungle. It took Dick some little time to recover himself sufficiently to return to the canoe. On arriving he said nothing of the peril to which he had been exposed, but heartily congratulated himself that he had means of transport without making their way through jungles and forests. As they advanced, they repeatedly came across evidences that the country had not been always, as now it was, utterly devoid of population. More than once they observed traces which betokened the former existence of villages, either some ruined palisades, or the debris of some thatched huts, or some solitary sacred tree within an enclosure would indicate that the death of a chief had, according to custom, made a native tribe migrate to new quarters. If natives were still dwelling in the district, as was just probable, they must have been living underground, only emerging at night like beasts of prey, from which they were only a grade removed. Dick Sands had every reason to feel convinced that cannibalism had been practiced in the neighborhood. 3 times as he was wandering in the forest, he had come upon piles of ashes and half-charred human bones, the remnants, no doubt, of a ghastly meal, and although he mentioned nothing of what he had seen to Mrs. Weldon, he made up his mind to go ashore as seldom as possible, and as often as he found it absolutely necessary to go, he gave Hercules strict directions to push off into midstream at the very first intimation of danger. A new cause of anxiety arose on the following evening, and made it necessary for them to take the most guarded measures of precaution. The riverbed had widened out into a kind of lagoon. On the right side of this, built upon piles in the water, not only was there a collection of about 30 huts, but the fires gleaming under the thatch made it evident that they were all inhabited. Unfortunately, the only channel of the stream flowed close under the huts, the river elsewhere being so obstructed with rocks that navigation of any kind was impossible. Nothing was more probable than that the natives would have set their nets all across the piles, and if so, the canoe would be sure to be obstructed. An alarm must inevitably be raised. Every caution seemed to be unavailing, because the canoe must follow the stream. However, in the lowest of whispers, Dick ordered Hercules to keep clear as much as he could of the worm-eaten timber. The night was very dark, and was equally an advantage and at a disadvantage, as while it permitted those on board to steer as they wanted, it did not prevent them from being seen. The situation became more and more critical. About 100 feet ahead, the channel was very contracted. Two natives, gesticulating violently, were seen squatting on the pilework. A few moments more, and their voices could be heard. It was obvious that they had seen the floating mass. Apprehending that it was going to destroy their nets, they yelled aloud and shouted for assistance. Instantly, 5 or 6 negroes scrambled down the piles and perched themselves upon the crossbeams. On board the canoe, the profoundest silence was maintained. Dick only signaled his directions to Hercules without uttering a word, while Jack performed his part by holding Dingo's mouth tightly closed to stop the low growlings which the faithful watchdog seemed resolved to make. But fortunately every sound was overpowered by the rushing of the stream and the clamor of the negroes as they hurriedly drew in their nets. If they should raise them in time, all might be well, but if, on the other hand, the canoe should get entangled, the consequences could hardly fail to be disastrous. The current in its narrow channel was so strong that Dick was powerless either to modify its course or to slacken it. Half a minute more, and the canoe was right under the woodwork, but the efforts of the natives had already elevated the nets so that the anticipated danger was happily escaped. But it chanced that in making its way through the obstacle, a large piece of the grass thatch got detached. One of the negroes raised a sudden shout of alarm, and it seemed only too probable that he had caught a sight of the travellers below and was informing his companions. This apprehension, too, was only momentary. The current had changed almost to a rapid and carried the canoe along with such velocity that the lacustrine village was quickly out of sight. "Steer to the left!" cried Dick, finding that the riverbed had again become clear. A stiff pull of the tiller made the craft fly in that direction. Dick went to the stern and scanned the moonlit waters. All was perfectly still. No canoe was in pursuit. Perhaps the natives had not one to use, but certain it was that when daylight dawned, no vestige of an inhabitant was to be seen. Nevertheless, Dick thought it prudent for a while to steer close under the shelter of the left-hand shore. By the end of the next 4 days, the aspect of the country had undergone a remarkable change. The jungle, having given place to a desert as dreary as the Kalahari itself, the river appeared interminable, and it became a matter of serious consideration how to get a sufficiency of food. Fish was scarce, or at least hard to catch, and the arid soil provided no means of sustenance for antelopes, so that nothing was to be gained from the chase. Carnivorous animals also had quite disappeared, and the silence of the night was broken, not by the roar of wild beasts, but by the croaking of frogs in a discordant chorus, which Cameron had compared to the clanking of hammers and the grating of files in a shipbuilder's yard. Far away both to the east and west the outlines of hills could be fairly discerned, but the shores on either hand were perfectly flat and devoid of trees. Euphorbias, it is true, grew in considerable numbers, but as they were only of the oil-producing species, and not the kind for which cassava or manioc is procured, they were useless in an elementary point of view. Dick was becoming more and more perplexed, when Hercules happened to mention that the natives often eat young fern fronds and the pith of the papyrus, and that before now he had himself been reduced to the necessity of subsisting on nothing better. "We must try them," said Dick. Both ferns and papyrus abounded on the banks, and a meal was prepared, the sweet soft pith of the papyrus being found very palatable. Jack in particular appeared to enjoy it extremely, but it was not in any way a satisfying diet. Thanks to Cousin Benedict, a fresh variety in the matter of food was found on the following day. Since the discovery of the Hexapodes Benedictus, he had recovered his spirits, and having fastened his prize safely inside his hat, he wandered about, as often as he had a chance, in his favorite pursuit of insect hunting. As he was rummaging in the long grass, he put up a bird which flew but a very short distance. Benedict recognized it by its peculiar note, and seeing Dick take his gun to aim at it, exclaimed, "Don't fire, don't fire! That bird will be worth nothing for food among 5 of us." "It will be dear enough for Jack," said Dick, who, finding that bird did not seem in a hurry to make his escape, delayed his shot for a moment, without intending to be diverted for his purpose of securing it. "You mustn't fire," insisted Dick. "It is an indicator. It will show you where there are lots of honey." Aware that a few pounds of honey would really be more of more value than a little bird, Dick lowered his gun, and in company with the entomologist set off to follow the indicator, which seemed, by alternately flying and stopping, to be inviting them to come on, and they had but a little way to go before they observed several swarms of bees buzzing around some old stems hidden amongst the euphorbias. Notwithstanding Benedict's remonstrances against depriving the bees of the fruits of their industry, Dick instantly set to work, and without remorse suffocated them by burning dry grass underneath.
Having secured a good amount of honey, he left the comb to the indicator as its share of the booty, and went back with his companion to the canoe. The honey was acceptable, but it did not do much to alleviate the cravings of hunger. Next day it happened that they just stopped for their accustomed rest when they observed that an enormous swarm of grasshoppers had settled at the mouth of a creek close by. Two or three deep they covered the soil, myriads and myriads of them adhering to every shrub. "The natives eat those grasshoppers," said Benedict, "and like them too." Their remark produced an instant effect. All hands were busied in collecting them, and a large supply was quickly gathered. The canoe might have been filled 10 times over. Grilled over a slow fire, they were found to be very palatable eating, and in spite of his qualms of conscience, Benedict himself made a hearty meal. But although the gnawings of absolute hunger were thus assuaged, all the travellers began to long most anxiously for the voyage to come to an end. The mode of transit, indeed, might be less exhausting to the bodily powers than a land march would have been, but the excessive heat by day, the damp mists at night, and the incessant attacks of mosquitoes all combined to render the passage extremely trying. There was no telling how long it would last, and Dick was equally uncertain whether it might end in a few days or be protracted for a month. The direction with which the stream was taking was itself a subject of perplexity. A fresh surprise was now in store. As Jack, a few mornings afterwards, was standing at the bow, peering through an aperture in the grass canopy above him, he suddenly turned round and cried, "The sea! The sea!" Dick started forwards and looked eagerly in the same direction. A large expanse of water was visible in the horizon, but after having surveyed it for a moment or two, he said, "No, Jack, it is not the sea. It is a great river. It is running west, and I suppose this river runs into it. Perhaps it is the Zaire." "Let us hope it is," said Mrs. Weldon earnestly. Most cordially did Dick Sands re-echo her words, being well aware that at the mouth of the river were Portuguese villages, where a refuge might assuredly be found. For several succeeding days the canoe, still concealed by its covering, floated on the silvery surface of this new-found stream. On either side the banks became less arid, and there seemed everything to encourage the few survivors of the Pilgrim to believe that they would soon see the last of the perils and toils of their journey. They were too sanguine. Towards 3 o'clock in the morning of the 18th, Dick, who was at his usual post at the bow, fancied he heard a dull rumbling towards the west. Mrs. Weldon, Jack, and Benedict were all asleep. Calling Hercules to him, he asked him whether he could not hear a strange noise. The night was perfectly calm, and not a breath of air was stirring. The negro listened attentively, and suddenly his eyes sparkling with delight exclaimed, "Yes, Captain, I hear the sea." Dick shook his head and answered, "It is not the sea, Hercules." "Not the sea?" cried the negro. "Then what can it be?" "We must wait till daybreak," replied Dick, "and meanwhile we shall have to keep a sharp lookout." Hercules returned to his place, but only to continue listening with ever-increasing curiosity. The rumbling perceptibly increased till it became a continued roar. With scarcely any intervening twilight, night passed into day. Just in front, scarcely more than half a mile ahead, a great mist was hanging over the river. It was not an ordinary fog, and when the sun rose, the light of the dawn caused a brilliant rainbow to arch itself from shore to shore. And a voice so loud that it awoke Mrs. Weldon, Dick gave his orders to Hercules to steer for the bank. "Quick, quick, Hercules! Ashore, ashore! There are cataracts close ahead!" And so it was. Within little more than a quarter of a mile, the bed of the river sank abruptly some 100 feet, and the foaming waters rushed down in a magnificent fall with irresistible velocity. A few minutes more, and the canoe must have been swallowed in the deep abyss. End of Part the Second, Chapter 18. Recording by Alex C. Talander, Davis, California. www.alexctalander.com. Part the Second, Chapter 19 of Dick Sands, the Boy Captain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alex C. Talander, Davis, California. Dick Sands, the Boy Captain, by Jules Verne, translated by Ellen E. Frewer. Part the Second, Chapter 19. An Attack. The canoe inclined to the west readily enough. The fall in the riverbed was so sudden that the current remained quite unaffected by the cataract at a distance of 300 yards. On the bank were woods so dense that sunlight could not penetrate the shade. Dick was conscious of a sad misgiving when he looked at the character of the territory through which they must necessarily pass. It did not seem practicable by any means to convey the canoe below the falls. As they neared the shore, Dingo became intensely agitated. At first Dick suspected that a wild beast or a native might be lurking in the papyrus, but it soon became obvious that the dog was excited by grief rather than by rage. "Dingo is crying," said Jack. "Poor Dingo!" and the child laid his arms over the creature's neck. The dog, however, was too impatient to be caressed, Bounding away, he sprang into the water, swam across the 20 feet that intervened between the shore, and disappeared in the grass. In a few moments the boat had glided onto a carpet of confervas and of other aquatic plants, starting a few kingfishers and some snow-white herons. Hercules moored it to the stump of a tree, and the travellers went ashore. There was no pathway through the forest. Only the trampled moss showed that the place had been recently visited, either by animals or men. Dick took his gun, and Hercules his hatchet, and they set out to search for Dingo. They had not far to go before they saw him with his nose on the ground, manifestly following a scent. The animal raised his head for a moment, as if beckoning them to follow, and kept on till he reached an old sycamore stump. Having called out to the rest of the party to join them, Dick made his way farther into the wood till he got up to Dingo, who was whining piteously at the entrance of a dilapidated hut. The rest were not long in following, and they all entered the hut together. The floor was strewn with bones whitened by exposure. "Someone has died here," said Mrs. Weldon. "Perhaps," added Dick, as if struck by a sudden thought, "it was Dingo's old master. Look at him, he is pointing with his paw." The portion of the sycamore trunk which formed the farther side of the hut had been stripped of its bark, and upon the smooth wood were two great letters, in ginger red, almost effaced by time, but yet plain enough to be distinguished. "S.V.," cried Dick, as he looked where the dog's paw rested. "The same initials that Dingo had as upon his collar. There can be no mistake. S.V.." A small copper box, green with verdigris, caught his eye, and he picked it up. It was open, but contained a scrap of discolored paper. The writing upon this consisted of a few sentences, of which only detached words could be made out, but they revealed the sad truth only too plainly. "Robbed by Negoro. Murdered. Dingo. Help. Negoro guide. 120 miles from coast. December 3rd, 1871. Night write no more. S. Vernon." Here was the clue to a melancholy story. Samuel Vernon, under the guidance of Negoro and taking with him his dog Dingo, had set out on an exploration of a district of Central Africa. He had taken a considerable quantity of money to procure the necessary supplies on the way, and this had excited the cupidity of his guide, who seized the opportunity, whilst they were encamping on the banks of the Congo, to assassinate his employer and get possession of his property. Negoro, however, had not escaped. He had fallen into the hands of the Portuguese, by whom he was recognized as an agent of the slave dealer Alves, and condemned to spend the rest of his days in prison. He contrived after a while to make his escape, and, as has already been mentioned, found his way to New Zealand, whence he had returned by securing an engagement on board the Pilgrim. Between the time when he was attacked by Negoro and the moment of his death, Vernon had managed to write the few brief lines of which the fragment still survived, and to deposit the document in the box from which the money had been stolen, and by a last effort had traced out his initials in blood upon the naked wood which formed the wall of the hut. For many days Dingo watched beside his master, and throughout that time his eyes were resting so perpetually upon the two crimson letters in front of him that mere instinct seemed to fasten them indelibly on his memory. Quitting his watch one day, perhaps to pacify his hunger, the dog wandered to the coast, where he was picked up by the captain of the Waldeck, afterwards to be transferred to the very ship on which his owner's murderer had been engaged as cook. All throughout this time, poor Vernon's bones had been bleaching in the African forest, and the first resolution of Dick and Mrs. Weldon was to give the residue of his remains some semblance of a decent burial. They were just proceeding to their task when Dingo gave a furious growl and dashed out of the hut. Another moment and a terrible shriek made it evident that he was in conflict with some dread antagonist. Hercules was quickly in pursuit, and the whole party followed in time to witness the giant hurl himself upon a man with whom already Dingo was in mortal combat. The dog was gripping the man by the throat, and the man was lifting his cutlass high above the head of the dog. That man was Negoro. The rascal, on getting his letter at Kazonde, instead of embarking at once for America, had left his native escort for a while and returned to the scene of his crime to secure the treasure, which he had left buried at a little distance in a spot that he had marked. At this very moment he was in the act of digging up the gold he had concealed. Some glistening coins scattered here and there betrayed his purpose, but in the midst of his labours he had been startled by the dashing forward of a dog. Another instant, and the dog had transfixed itself upon his throat, whilst he, in an agony of desperation, had drawn his cutlass and plunged it deep into the creature's side. Hercules came up at the very climax of the death struggle. "You villain! You accursed villain! I have you now!" he cried, about to seize hold of his victim. But vengeance was already accomplished. Negoro gave no sign of life. Death had overtaken him on the very scene of his guilt. Dingo, too, had received a mortal wound. He dragged himself back to the hut, lay down beside the remains of his master, and expired. The sad task of burying Vernon's bones, and laying his faithful dog beside them, having been accomplished, the whole party was obliged to turn their thoughts to their own safety. Although Negoro was dead, it is very likely that the natives that he had taken with him were at no great distance, and would come to search for him. A hurried conference was held as to what steps had best to be taken. The few words traceable on the paper made them aware that they were on the banks of the Congo, and that they were still 120 miles from the coast. The fall just ahead was probably the cataract of Memo, but whatever it was, no doubt it effectually barred their farther progress by water. There seemed no alternative but that they should make their way by one bank or the other a mile or two below the waterfall, and there construct a raft on which once again they could drift down the stream. The question that pressed for immediate settlement was which bank it should be. Here on the left bank would be the greater risk of encountering the negro escort of Negoro, whilst at the other farther shore they could not tell what obstacles they might present. Altogether Mrs. Weldon advocated trying the other side, but Dick insisted upon crossing first by himself to ascertain whether an advance by that route was really practicable. "The river is only about 100 yards wide," he urged. "I can soon get across. I shall leave Hercules to look after you all." Mrs. Weldon demurred for a while, but Dick seemed resolute, and as he promised to take his gun and not to attempt to land if he saw the least symptom of danger, she at last consented, but with so much reluctance that even after he had entered the canoe, she said, "I think, Dick, it would be really better for us all to go together." "No, Mrs. Weldon, indeed no. I am sure it is best for me to go alone. I shall be back in an hour." "If it must be so, it must," said the lady. "Keep a sharp lookout, Hercules," cried the youth cheerily, as he pushed off from the land. The strength of the current was by no means violent, but quite enough to make the direction of Dick's course somewhat oblique. The roar of the cataract reverberated in his ears, and the spray, wafted by the westerly wind, brushed lightly past his face, and he shuddered as he felt how near they must have been to destruction if he had relaxed his watch throughout the night. It took him hardly a quarter of an hour to reach the opposite bank, and he was just preparing to land when there arose a tremendous shout from above a dozen natives, who, rushing forward, began to tear away the canopy of grass with which the canoe was covered. Dick's horror was great. It would have been greater still if he had known that they were cannibals. They were the natives settled at the lacustrine village, higher up the river. When the piece of thatch had been knocked off in passing the piles, a glimpse had been caught of the passengers below, and aware that the cataract ahead must ultimately bring them to a standstill, the eager barbarians had followed them persistently day by day for the last 8 days. Now they thought they had secured their prize, but loud was their yell of disappointment when, on stripping off the thatch, they found only one person, and that a mere boy, standing beneath it. Dick stood as calmly as he could at the bow, and pointed his gun towards the savages, who were sufficiently acquainted with the nature of firearms to make them afraid to attack. Mrs. Weldon with the others, in their eagerness to watch Dick's movements, had remained standing upon the shore of the river, and at this instant were caught sight by one of the natives, who pointed them out to his companions. A sudden impulse seized the whole of them, and they sprang into the canoe. There seemed to be a practiced hand amongst them, which caught hold of the rudder oar, and the little craft was quickly on its way back. Although he gave up all as now well nigh lost, Dick neither moved nor spoke. He had one lingering hope yet left. Was it not possible, even now, that by sacrificing his own life he could save the lives of those who were entrusted to him? When the canoe had come near enough to the shore for his voice to be heard, he shouted with all his might, "Fly, Mrs. Weldon! Fly, all of you! Fly for your lives!" But neither Mrs. Weldon nor Hercules stirred. They seemed rooted to the ground. "Fly, fly, fly!" he continued shouting. But though he knew they must hear him, yet he saw them make no effort to escape. He understood their meaning, and of what avail was flight when the savages would be upon their track in a few minutes after. A sudden thought crossed his mind. He raised his gun and fired at the man who was steering. The bullets shattered the rudder skull into fragments. The cannibals uttered a yell of terror. Deprived of guidance, the canoe was at the mercy of the current, and, borne along with increasing speed, was soon within 100 feet of the cataract. The anxious watchers on the bank instantly discerned Dick's purpose, and understood that in order to save them he had formed the resolution of precipitating himself with the savages into the seething waters. Nothing could avail to arrest the swift descent. Mrs. Weldon, in an agony of despair, waved her hands in a last sad farewell. Jack and Benedict seemed paralyzed, whilst Hercules involuntarily extended his straight strong arm that was powerless to aid. Suddenly the natives, impelled by a last frantic effort to reach the shore, plunged into the water, but then movement capsized the boat. Face to face with death, Dick lost nothing of his indomitable presence of mind. Might not that light canoe, floating bottom upwards, be made the means for yet another grasp at life? The danger that threatened him was twofold. There was the risk of suffocation as well as the peril of being drowned. Could not the inverted canoe be used for a kind of float at once to keep his head above water and to serve as a screen from the rushing air? He had some faint recollection of how it had been proved possible under some such conditions to descend in safety the falls of Niagara. Quick as lightning, he seized hold of the cross-bench of the canoe, and with his head out of the water, beneath the upturned keel, he was dashed down the furious and well-nigh perpendicular fall. The craft sank deep into the abyss, but rose quickly again to the surface. Here was Dick's chance. He was a good swimmer, and his life depended now upon his strength of arm. It was a hard struggle, but he succeeded. In a quarter of an hour he had landed on the left-hand bank, where he was greeted with the joyful congratulations of his friends, who had hurried to the foot of the fall to assure themselves of his fate. The cannibals had all disappeared in the surging waters. Unprotected in their fall, they had doubtless ceased to breathe before reaching the lowest depths of the cataract, where their lifeless bodies would soon be dashed to pieces against the sharp rocks that were scattered along the lower course of the stream. End of part the second, chapter 19. Recording by Alex C. Talander, Davis, California. www.alexctalander.com. Part the second, chapter 20, of Dick Sands, the Boy Captain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alex C. Talander, Davis, California. Dick Sands, the Boy Captain, by Jules Verne. Translated by Ellen E. Frewer. Part the second, chapter 20. A Happy Reunion. 2 days after Dick's marvelous deliverance, the party had the good fortune to fall in with a caravan of honest Portuguese ivory traders on their way to Mboma, at the mouth of the Congo. They rendered the fugitives every assistance, and thus enabled them to reach the coast without further discomfort. This meeting with the caravan was a most fortunate occurrence, as that any project of launching a raft upon the Zaire would have been quite impracticable, the river between the Ntemo and Yalala Falls being a continuous series of cataracts. Stanley counted as many as 62, and it was hereabouts that that brave traveller sustained the last of 31 conflicts with the natives, escaping almost by a miracle from the Mbelo Cataract. Before the middle of August, the party arrived at Mboma, where they were hospitably received by M. Mota Viega and Mr. Harrison. A steamer was just on the point of starting for the Isthmus of Panama, and this they took their passage and in due time set foot once more upon American soil. Forthwith a message was dispatched to Mr. Weldon, apprising him of the return of the wife and child, over whose loss he had mourned so long. On the 25th the railroad deposited the travellers at San Francisco, the only thing to mar the happiness being the recollection that Tom and his partners were not with them to share their joy. Mr. Weldon had every reason to congratulate himself that Negoro had failed to reach him. No doubt he would have been ready to sacrifice the bulk of his fortune, and without a moment's hesitation would have set out for the coast of Africa, but who could question that he would there have been exposed to the vilest treachery? He felt that to Dick Sands and to Hercules he owed a debt of gratitude that it would be impossible to repay. Dick assumed more than ever the place of an adopted son, whilst the brave negro was regarded as a true and faithful friend. Cousin Benedict, it must be owned, failed to share for long the general joy. After giving Mr. Weldon a hasty shake of the hand, he hurried off to his private room and resumed his studies almost as if they had never been interrupted. He set himself vigorously to work with the design of producing an elaborate treatise upon the Hexapodes Benedictus, hitherto unknown to entomological research. Here in his private chamber spectacles and magnifying glass were ready for his use, and he was now able for the first time, with the aid of proper appliances, to examine the new production of Central Africa. A shriek of horror and disappointment escaped his lips. The Hexapodes Benedictus was not a hexapod at all. It was a common spider. Hercules, in catching it, had unfortunately broken off its two front legs, and Benedict, almost blind as he was, had failed to detect the accident. His chagrin was most pitiable. The wonderful discovery that was to have exalted his name high in the annals of science belonged simply to the common order of the Arachnidae. The blow to his aspirations was very heavy. It brought on a fit of illness, from which he took him some time to recover. For the next 3 years Dick was entrusted with the education of little Jack, during the intervals he could spare from the prosecution of his own studies, into which he threw himself with an energy quickened by a kind of remorse. "If only I had known what a seaman ought to know when I was left to myself on board the Pilgrim," he would continue to say, "what misery and suffering we might have been spared." So diligently did he apply himself to the technical branches of his profession that at the age of 18 he received a special certificate of honor, and was at once raised to the rank of a captain in Mr. Weldon's firm. Thus by his industry and good conduct did the poor foundling of Sandy Hook rise to a post of distinction. In spite of his youth he commanded universal respect. His native modesty and straightforwardness never failed him, and for his own part he seemed to be unconscious of those fine traits in his character which had impelled him to deeds that made him little short of a hero. His leisure moments, however, were often troubled by one source of sadness. He could never forget the four negroes for whose misfortune he held himself by his own inexperience to be in a way responsible. Mrs. Weldon thoroughly shared his regret, and would have made many sacrifices to discover what had become of them. This anxiety was at length relieved. Owing to the large correspondence of Mr. Weldon in almost every quarter of the world, it was discovered that the whole of them had been sold in one lot, and that they were now in Madagascar. Without listening for a moment to Dick's proposal to apply all his savings to effect their liberation, Mr. Weldon sent his own agents to negotiate for their freedom, and on the 15th of November, 1877, Tom, Bat, Actaeon, and Austin awaited their welcome at the merchant's door. It is needless to say how warm were the greetings they received. Out of all the survivors of the pilgrim that had been cast upon the fatal coast of Africa, old Nan alone was wanting to complete the number. Considering what they had all undergone, and the perils to which they had been exposed, it seemed little short of a miracle that she and poor Dingo should be the only victims. High was the festivity that night in the house of the California merchant, and the toast proposed at Mrs. Weldon's request that was received with the loudest acclamation was, "Dick Sands, the boy captain." End of part the second, chapter 20. Recording by Alex E. Talander, Davis, California. www.alexetalander.com. End of Dick Sands, the boy captain, by Jules Verne. Translated by Ellen E. Frewer.
Plan on flying? It's time to upgrade to a real ID. Because in order to board domestic flights, your driver's license or state-issued ID must be a real ID, or you'll need another acceptable form of identification. So don't wait. Find out how to get your real ID at tsa.gov/real ID. That's tsa.gov/real ID. Or visit your local DMV. And then you'll be cleared for takeoff.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Families agents. Life's better when you're under American Families roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.